Welcome to Church Ahead, the weekly Christian podcast talking about big questions facing the future of church with Rev L, all the way from the north of England. Episode 90, Resurrection God. How's our bus passenger Maria doing on her way to work in Dallas? We'll find out next week. Meanwhile, at the other end of America, we're going to meet a man today who has never, ever been a bus passenger because they are just for the little people. Hi, this is Bob. At my desk in the corner office, 89th floor of the Sears Tower, here in Chicago. Illinois legal people, just call me God. Sort of rhymes with Bob, and you won't forget me. Back in the 20th century, I fixed this law firm. Today, my mission is to fix Church Ahead and give Rev L, this sweet English theologian, a helping hand by telling you how I fixed up my prodigal son. You're going to love my story. Just don't tell the boy. Thank you, Bob. We look forward to hearing your story later on today. Yes, we're on to God. We've spent 2 weeks talking about how the resurrection affects our picture of Jesus. Today we move on to how the resurrection of Jesus Christ shapes our view of God. Resurrection has always been taken as a statement about God. The two main actors in the resurrection drama are God the Son and God the Father, perhaps working with the power of God the Holy Spirit. Acts 2:24 is typical. But God raised him from the dead. Whilst apostolic Christianity does not normally attribute the death of Jesus to God himself, when it comes to the resurrection, the credit always goes to God. Jesus did not get himself out of the grave. Still less did the resurrection happen by random freak chance. Without question, it was God what done it. Jesus might be the object of the resurrection, but God is usually the subject. God raises Jesus, and in doing so, says a great deal about his own nature and his ways. But what does resurrection say about God? What does resurrection reveal about its divine author? I'm afraid the first thing that I think resurrection says about God is that God is an interfering meddler. Yes, the traditional answer is that God demonstrates power over the forces of death through a decisive intervention into space-time history. Now, there was a time in salvation history when it was taken for granted that God shows his power by intervening in the natural course of events. And who wants a weak God incapable of timely intervention? Certainly not the biblical hero Elijah, who challenged the prophets of Baal to a contest to see which God could answer the prophets by fire. The winner, of course, was not the rival fertility God, but the God of Israel, 1 Kings 18. The Christianity of my youth had a slightly dismal view of this earthly life. The assumption was that down here, in this mundane and mediocre world, we don't see very much of God's glory very often. But in the resurrection, we are briefly dazzled by a flash of heavenly glory as God broke through the gloom of this world. The resurrection is exhibit number one of divine intervention for anyone willing to open their eyes. The problem is that we are not quite so keen on an interventionist God any longer. This version of God as generally somewhere else, punctuated by the occasional visit here to interfere with the laws of nature, has been losing ground ever since the Enlightenment. The problem with the God of the gaps is that science keeps shrinking the gaps. Desperate souls may turn to God in crisis for help, but most of the time we prefer him to stay away and leave us to enjoy the natural course of this world. Traditional Christianity has a difficult job in selling the divine intervention of resurrection into a world with less time for God sticking his oar in. Harry Enfield is a wonderful English comedian. Although he's from Sussex, I would like to give him a Church Ahead Award as an honorary Northerner because he has some very good Yorkshire characters. And the resurrection often reminds me of his irritating but credible character who manages to annoy most of the people he meets. This man, he's a London character, gets on a bus and starts collecting the bus fares for the conductor. He walks past a dog walker and takes the dog lead into his hands. His words are invariably something like, "You don't want to do that. You want to do this. Let me show you." As the viewer, you wish he would simply learn to mind his own business and leave people alone. But his whole purpose in life is to interfere where he's not wanted, usually with advice which is equally unwanted. When I try to work out what modern people don't like about an interventionist God, I often think of this Harry Enfield character. There may well have been a time when intervention meant powerful help, but to 21st century people, intervention of that sort feels like interference. We do not really want it. Peter and Paul might have proclaimed God's power seen in resurrection, but for many today, it feels like the weakness of meddling, someone who just can't leave things alone. Next point, God is not creator, but confuser. In resurrection, God interferes with the basic structures of life in a way that bewilders and confuses many people. The expression, "meet your maker," is widely accepted as a euphemism for death, even for those without much sense of God as creator. We can cope with mortality as the life's boundary set by God, but not if he messes about with it, altering the relationship between life and death in this world at will. If God is creator and he designed the sequence of life and death, why would he want to play around with it? The only life we know involves death as a given. Resurrection undermines this. The most basic gift every person receives from their creator is the gift of life in this world, which includes death. Embracing this is perhaps the most basic spiritual challenge human beings ever face. Revering God as creator is in part about respecting the reality of life and death. Why would God want to cloud this simple fact of life, the life that he has made? There is a real conflict, I think, between God as creator and God as of resurrection. And I suppose I would rather have the creator at ease with his creation. Is there a bit of Frankenstein here? The way resurrection erodes the clarity and finality of death finds an echo in one surprisingly contemporary place. There are today a number of cutting-edge scientists working on the project of helping humans to fend off death and to live a lot longer, if not forever. As Israeli historian Yuval Harari says in his book Homo Deus, 21st century humans are likely to make a serious bid for immortality. Death is increasingly seen as a technical problem to be fixed, and all the time our medical tools are gaining effectiveness. He says even if we don't achieve immortality in our lifetime, the war against death is still likely to be the flagship project of the coming century. The God of Resurrection feels eerily similar to these utopian scientists. I can't avoid the sense that they are simply tilting at the reality of life and its natural limitations. Of course, I'm unable to say whether there's mileage in their research, and perhaps one day it will yield fruit. But for the foreseeable future, death is quite simply a part of life, and a God who tries to say otherwise feels to me rather chilling, more like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein than the God I want anything to do with. The philosopher John Gray has surveyed many of the modern movements aiming to give us life after the normal human lifespan, and he makes this important observation. I quote, "The pursuit of immortality through science is only incidentally a project aiming to defeat death, At the bottom, it's an attempt to escape contingency and mystery. Contingency means humans will always be subject to fate and chance. Mystery, that they will always be surrounded by the unknowable. For many, this is intolerable. Using advancing knowledge, they insist the human animal can transcend the human condition. End of quote. That's from the Immortalization Commission, page 213. I think this description applies equally well to literal-minded Christians who believe in a physical resurrection, Jesus and their own. They're struggling with the fact that death is unpredictable. I could live another 50 years or I could die tomorrow. And they cannot cope with the greatest mystery of death. We just don't know what death is like. One group tries to bring scientific certainty, the other religious certainty. They are both equally unhelpful. The real challenge is to embrace the mystery. The mainly male technologists and scientists concentrated in California's Silicon Valley are often contrasted with the mainly female force of health workers and counselors all over the world trying to help mortal humans face up to the reality of death in our families and in our own bodies. Human lifespan may well continue its march forwards, but I would still prefer a God who is more like a compassionate doctor helping me come to terms with a cancer diagnosis than a salesman for the wonder drug of immortality. In one sense, resurrection takes God forward to the future realm of science fiction, but mostly it takes him back to the badly behaved God of the Old Testament. So my next accusation against the God of resurrection is favoritism. If God could pick out one human being from history to experience resurrection, why should it be Jesus? I can see how he might be one of the world's most deserving candidates, but does he really stand out head and shoulders above every other great man and woman who's died for their cause? I can see the value in God showing up the error of those who condemn Jesus. But if every victim of unjust execution in history was to rise from their death, there'd be millions of resurrections, and so nothing very special about Jesus. Nepotism by God the Father for God the Son? Favoritism? Special pleading? St. Paul makes the problem even worse by linking the resurrection of Jesus to the resurrection of all Christians in 1 Corinthians 15. Why should Christianity be the membership card for the resurrection club? If most people are going to live out their 3 school years and 10 and then die, end of, but God selects a lucky group of good people to experience a second wind of life, what makes this group so deserving of divine favour? Now, leaving aside the question, of course, of whether anyone would ever want this strange resurrection existence in the first place, what sort of God would want to restrict this bliss to Christians alone? The life of Jesus is supposed to reveal a new face of God. The coming of God the Son is meant to reveal fresh insights into the character of God the Father. But the God of resurrection feels to me more like a regression to the tribal God of the Old Testament. Once again, we see a God who wants his gang to live whilst all around perish. In Exodus, God helps his children escape slavery, walking through the parted waters of the Red Sea, which immediately come back to drown their enemy. A God who wants to shorten life for some and lengthen life for others. This grotesquely partisan God belongs to the ancient past of religion. Think superstition and fear. This is not a God to love voluntarily. This is a God to be scared of getting on the wrong side of. This God might get a hearing in societies where the sheer struggle of life breeds vulnerability to fatalism, where divine displeasure sounds like a better explanation for illness than a virus. There are plenty of countries like this, and Christianity is growing in many of them, but not in modern Europe, We do not feel awe in the face of such a God. We feel contempt. We feel the plight of the Canaanites slaughtered by Joshua's conquest. We feel the discrimination against millions of non-Christians shut out from the resurrection rescue. We do not want a God who arbitrarily picks favourites based on ethnicity or religious affiliation. To our generation, it seems immoral. The next charge against the resurrection God is that he is a harsh judge. The New Testament doesn't really give a clear, consistent picture of exactly what happens at the general resurrection. Will it be confined to Christians alone? If the unjust rise, what will be their fate? Is the resurrection body a spiritual version of the earthly body or something completely different altogether? How does resurrection map onto heaven? What is clear is that this later resurrection has got something to do with the return of Christ and the final judgment. Assumed to be the end of the world, this resurrection brings together one of the most implausible claims about Christ with one of the most unpopular doctrines about God. While some hardcore fundamentalist Christians live in perpetual suspense as they wait for Jesus' return, most Christians take very little notice of this supposedly world-changing event. They're not exactly sat on the edge of their seats, waiting in eager anticipation. Again, the prospect of God judging the whole of humanity on whatever basis, separating them out into the saved versus the damned, is an idea which belongs to church history. Mainstream church does not like to talk about God in this sort of way. Christians who look forward to the day of judgment are thin on the ground. Again, resurrection links God to a character and a behaviour most Christians like to think he has progressed out of. Marilyn Robinson is a wonderful contemporary fiction writer, most of whose books are set in and around church life in America. One of her characters, Lila, hears about the Last Judgment from her elderly ordained husband after a very troubled life, which includes seeing Doll, the woman who brought her up, prosecuted for knifing Lila's father to death. I'm going to quote to you from page 101 of Lila. Whatever it was she did with that knife, who would want to cause her more sorrow? Lila hated the thought of resurrection more than she'd ever hated anything. Better Doll should stay in her grave, if she had one. Better nothing the old men said should be true at all. Lila recoils against the notion that someone who's endured a hard life would be woken up to answer for their mistakes. I suspect Lila speaks for many. The prospect of God disturbing the long dead by waking them up in order to give them a guilty verdict, followed by the sentence of eternal condemnation, does sound rather unkind. Wake them up for what? Kill them again? Torment them? Send them down to hell? You think he might just leave them alone in their slumber? I began last year's politics series telling you about the early May morning in 1979 when my mother came into my bedroom and woke me up to tell me Britain had its first female prime minister. She'd voted for Margaret Thatcher, and so for her the election of the Conservative Party was good news. For me, the Labour Party represented the political wing of God's kingdom. Margaret Thatcher was the she-devil. As a young man, I always linked those two events, the election of a destructive Tory government and my mother's teasing voice as I came to, waking me up to the news of national disaster. Waking someone to bad news can be slightly cruel. In Orthodox Christianity, that is what Jesus' return, followed by general resurrection, means for the great unwashed majority of humanity. They rise to be told that they were on the wrong side of history and must now face the consequence. My final charge against the God of resurrection is that he is remote, far removed, and reluctant to stick around. Are you ready, Bob? You're on soon. We have already seen how closely linked resurrection is to ascension and Jesus' escape from this world. God's rescue of his son from death was a two-stage operation. First, get him out of the grave, then put him on a magic carpet up to heaven. We've considered how this reverses the incarnation. Now it's time to ask, what does this myth suggest about the God who takes his son back to heaven? A God who loves this world and is completely at ease with his son spending as much time here as possible? No, more of a remote, transcendent God who is far removed from this earth and not too thrilled about his son spending a lot of time here. Now, Bob is emphatically not a bus passenger, and he's far too busy to wait for buses. He's a big-shot lawyer in Chicago, and he's been very busy over this last year, watching over his teenage son Ralph's gap year between school and university. Bob, the father, is well aware how important this year is to Ralph, the son. Go wherever you want, son. Not everyone in this world enjoys our privileges, and I want you to really see what the world is like. If you get into trouble, I'm just a phone call away, and we've got family friends on every continent. So to test the boundaries, Ralph picks a sub-Saharan country in civil war. Dad isn't exactly thrilled with the choice, but doesn't want to spoil the experience by complaining too much. Just be careful, son, is Bob's parting plea. The boy does 6 months really good work in a missionary school. He's a natural teacher and the pupils love him. All is going well until the rebels come to town and even the school is drawn into the Civil War. There's a tense meeting of the teachers of the school who are anxiously trying to work out what they should do. Ralph is sat in the corner with a couple of other nervous white teenagers. And Ralph is wondering whether to send a message home for help. Just at that moment, into the room walk four armed American private security guards carrying Ralph's photo. Within 10 minutes, Ralph is sat in the back seat of a 4x4 combat vehicle flanked by similar vehicles in front and behind in a convoy to the capital city airport. Within 4 hours, he is sipping iced Coca-Cola on an aeroplane back to the American Midwest. Weeks later, Ralph makes two very depressing discoveries. First of all, he learns that most of the good people he taught with at the school have been killed by the rebels. But almost as bad, he's learning that his father had the private security firm 5 miles from the orphanage on standby, just in case, for the whole of his stay at the orphanage. Bob is pleased that the boy had a good year, but what really elates him is having the boy back home safe. Over an intimate lunch with an old friend, Bob confides, I have really nothing against war-torn, sub-Saharan SHIT holes and their civil wars. It's just I prefer my son in Chicago. When Ralph finds out about the private security firm being there all year, there's an angry ding-dong between father and son. Ralph threatens to go back. The only way Bob can talk him out of it is to set up a scholarship scheme to pay for 6 boys from the school to come and study at a high school in the US. In the end, Bob convinces him this will do more good. The resurrection ascension operation leaves us with a Jesus whose feet are no longer on this earth and a God who seems glad the boy did not stay in this world for too long. A God who can tolerate this world for a little while but doesn't want his son to get stuck here. A God who wants a hands-off relationship with this planet. A few earthlings might join him in heaven, but he does not want to get over-involved with this place. Forget incarnation. So in conclusion, yes, the resurrection says some very important things about God. The only problem is they're not things that many of us want to hear. Thank you to Bob for fixing Church Ahead, And thank you to all of you for listening to episode 90, probably the most brain-busting, hardest and longest episode of the year. Next week, what does the resurrection do for us?